Okay, so let's continue on this Abhidhamma Sutta. And so far we have seen how the Abhidhamma, this delusion, this not understanding of reality as it actually is, how it comes about, and how it is rooted in the end in the not seeing the superior people, not seeing the Aryan, the noble ones, and of course, in particular, the Buddha himself. And then there is a nice summary of this, and also a nice simile to explain how this works. So have a look at that first of all, and then we'll have a look at the reverse sequence afterwards. So this is what the Buddha says, thus not associating with good persons. Becoming full, filled up, not hearing the good Dhamma, not hearing the good Dhamma, becoming full, filled up, lack of faith. Lack of faith, or lack of confidence, if you like, becoming full, fills up careless or unwise attention. Unwise attention, becoming full, fills up lack of mindfulness and lack of clear comprehension. Lack of mindfulness and clear comprehension, becoming full, fills up non-restraint of the sense faculties. Non-restraint of the sense faculties becoming full fills up the three kinds of misconduct. The three kinds of misconduct becoming full fill up the five hindrances. And the five hindrances becoming full fill up delusion. And fill up this avijja. Thus there is nutriment for avijja, for delusion. And in this way it becomes full. Yeah? So there is a gradual filling up, and of course the very first sequence here, it has a very, the very first aspect has a very indirect effect on the last one. It has to run through all the other 10 qualities here to reach the last one, so it takes a long time for it to work its way through. But eventually, the very first factor here actually fills up the very last one in this way. And then there's this nice simile which kind of makes it clear how this actually works. Just as when it is raining and the rain pours down in thick droplets on a mountaintop, the water flows down along the slope and fills the clefts, the gullies and the creeks. These becoming full fill up the pools. These becoming full fill up the lakes. These becoming full fill up the streams. And these becoming full fill up the rivers. And these becoming full fill up the great ocean. Thus there is nutriment for the great ocean, and in this way it becomes fuller. In the same way, not associating with good people, etc., takes you all the way to filling up ignorance, or filling up delusion itself. Thus there is nutriment for delusion, in this way it becomes fuller. So delusion becoming full sounds like a bad idea, right? So we try to... So this is how it happens. So it, you know, you keep on raining on that mountaintop, and as the rain kind of heaps up more and more, as it rains, because you are associating with the wrong people, you're led in the wrong direction. And then one thing after the other builds up and builds up and builds up, until the ocean itself, the delusion, it's filled up at the very end. Of course, the reverse is true. The reverse we're going to have a look at now. And that is, of course, far more inspiring when you see the reverse one. When you see the reverse one, you see that by, again, allowing the rain to fall on the mountaintop, and then the rain is associating with the superior people, it is hearing the good Dhamma, yeah? So you keep on doing that. You keep it, allow it to rain, and it rains, and it rains, and it rains. It's a good thing that we live in Northern Europe, because it rains an awful lot around here, right? So you allow the rain to keep on coming down, and down, and down, and down. And as it rains, as you listen to those suttas, as you read those suttas, as you hang out with the Sattarisa, the superior people, gradually the streams get fuller. Yeah, then the lakes, small lakes, then the large lakes, then the big rivers, and ultimately the ocean itself gets filled up. And only for one reason, because the rain keeps falling on that mountaintop. Yeah, it's a very nice simile. So keep that rain coming. And as you do that, eventually all of these things fill up, and eventually the ocean itself must become filled up as a consequence. Of course, it's not a very, it's not a perfect metaphor, because or it's perfect simile, because in reality the ocean doesn't really fill up. It's because it's kind of a closed system, of course. But in the similar here, it kind of, you know, you have to kind of read a little bit into it, and then you see what's happening, what's going on here. So very nice simile there here. So let's have a look at the reverse side and see how that works out. It says, so the Buddha says, I say, bhikkhus, that true knowledge and liberation. Do you think it's a good idea to close the window? Maybe. Is that a good idea? It's a bit noisy out there. Are we going to suffocate in here if we close the window? Are we going to be okay? Yeah. Yeah. Great. Thank you. Okay, so then we have the reverse sequence. I say, bhikkhus, that true knowledge and liberation have a nutriment. They are not without nutriment. And what is the nutriment for true knowledge and liberation? It should be said the seven factors of awakening here. The satta sangbodhangas is the cause, the nutriment for true knowledge and liberation. Yeah, so first of all, what do we mean by true knowledge and liberation? And you probably have some idea about that already. True knowledge, of course, here is vijja, the opposite of delusion. And it is what I said before, might be better translated as insight. Yeah, the three real insights in the world, the insight into past lives, understanding the laws of karma, and the final insight, which is the breakthrough to arahantship itself, to become fully awakened. Yeah, and of course that implies all the other insights on the path, impermanence, suffering, non-self, all of that is part of this true knowledge. Dependent origination is included in that. It's amazing, one flash of insight and you see all of this, yeah, this bang, and kind of the whole world opens up in a new way here. So there's a lot of, it's very kind of, that one insight is pregnant with a lot of understanding, lot of wisdom, lot of consequences, if you like. And that's why one flash of insight can give you so much understanding. Even rebirth itself is part of this understanding. You don't actually have to remember your past lives to know about rebirth, because that's part of the understanding of dependent origination. When you understand dependent origination, you understand the causality, the law of cause and effect. And that law of cause and effect is enough to know that rebirth must be a reality. Even though you haven't actually recalled your past lives, through understanding causality, you will understand the idea of rebirth. Yeah, so it, all of that is part of that knowledge there, if you like. Yeah. Then there is liberation. Not only do you have knowledge, but that knowledge has consequences. And the consequence of that knowledge is that you are liberated. Liberated from what? Well, of course, the main liberation is the liberation from suffering. Yeah, this is what the whole path is about, to end the suffering. And the ending of suffering, of course, is equivalent to the highest happiness. These things are obviously go together there. But not only that, you're also liberated from things like all the defilements of the mind. Because the defilements of the mind are the things that trap us and enslave us and may actually make life miserable. You take away the defilements and you kind of feel freed from these oppressors inside of you. You literally feel free. And this is what this is showing us here. So all the goodness of the path we're talking about here, all the wisdom, the insights, the liberation, all of that comes through the sequence from the ending of delusion and seeing things according to reality. This is what the Buddha is promising us, yeah? Very kind of astonishing promise, but pretty good if it's true. So how does this come about? And what the Buddha says here is that it comes about by the seven factors of awakening here. Yeah, the satta sambodhangas. This is the cause of this. So what does that actually mean? And what it means, if you have discussed the seven factors of awakening very briefly before, and what they are in a nutshell, they're all about samadhi practice, and also to some extent about satipatthana practice. They are, if you like, the seven factors are an expansion of the last two factors of the Noble Eightfold Path. So you put those two last factors together and they can be expanded into the seven factors of awakening. That's what they are. So they're all about samadhi, really. All about moving towards samadhi. Yeah. And this, of course, rings a bell, right? What is the cause for liberation and true insight? It is samadhi. It's one of those things that when you start reading the suttas, one of those themes that reoccur again and again and again across the suttas everywhere. Samadhi is always the cause for seeing things according to reality, having true insight, true knowledge, and liberation, all of these things. Here, it may not be so obvious unless you know what these things actually mean. It may not be so obvious, so sometimes it needs to be pointed out for it to be clear what is going on here. So samadhi is the cause, yeah? Just like we saw in this other sequence we looked at before, when we looked at what I call the psychology of meditation, or the you can also call it the dependent liberation that we looked at before. Similar kind of sequence. Samadhi is required for yathabuddha nanadasana, seeing things according to reality. So what are these seven factors of awakening in a little bit more detail? I thought this might be an opportunity to discuss them in a bit more detail to see what they are. And first of all, what does it actually mean, a factor of awakening? What does it actually refer to? And it is actually defined in the sutta as the seven things, the seven factors that lead to awakening. So these are the things that lead to awakening. Yeah, that is what it actually means. So how do they work? And as with everything else I was saying before, everything else has a certain structure. And these seven factors also have a certain structure. The most basic one being the sati sambodhanga, the factor of awakening, that is mindfulness comes first. And it ends up, the last one is the upeka sambodhanga, the factor of awakening, which is equanimity or evenness of mind. And each one leads on to the next one in a causal sequence. Yeah, so it is a standard kind of causal sequence that we see everywhere else. So, how does it work? And the way it works is, of course, the sati sambodhanga, being the mindfulness factor of awakening, is obviously, this kind of makes sense, and we'll see it afterwards anyway, is related very much to the satipatthanas, sammasati, the seventh factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. It kind of makes sense because it is the sati sambodhanga, the mindfulness factor of awakening here. So that kind of ties in with the satipatthana straight away. And the next factor, of course, that we will see here, which builds up under the sambodhanga, is precisely satipatthana, yeah? So we can see how these things kind of fit together, it fits together anyway, yeah? So, and then once you have the sati sambodhanga, maybe first of all, yeah, it can be regarded as the satipatthanas, in other words, the four applications of mindfulness. But there's also another way of looking at the sati sambodhanga, and that is to as a contemplation of the Dhamma, what the Dhamma actually means to you. What is called in the sutta the Dhamma nusati, the recollection of the Dhamma. Yeah. So by recalling the Dhamma and remembering what the Dhamma means, that this is a teaching to the highest happiness, that this is a teaching which kind of gives results straight away. And that understanding of the Dhamma, or it could also be the Buddha, or it could be anything really, that gives rise to the kind of the wholesome joy which then abandons the defilements. That's another way of doing the practicing the sati sambodhanga. Both of these ways are actually mentioned in the suttas themselves. Basically, it's about what it is about, really. It's about overcoming the defilements of the mind. That's really what it refers to. Look at Satipatthana Sutta and see how it is laid out. It is all about understanding the bad qualities of mind, overcoming those, and then moving towards the good qualities of mind. That is what Satipatthana really is all about. And we can have more of a look at that later on. Then, from the sati sambodhanga comes the second factor of awakening, which is the dhamma vicaya sambodhanga. And this is the factor of awakening, which is the investigation into qualities. Yeah, and this is defined in the suttas as understanding blameworthy qualities and blameless qualities. Savajja, anavajja dhamma. Qualities that are dark and bright. Yeah. And there's one other thing in there, which... anyway, it's the same kind of idea. So in other words, it is about investigating those aspects of the mind that are problematic, that are going to stop you from entering samadhi. In other words, defilements, that sort of stuff. And on the other side, those qualities that actually bring about samadhi, the positive qualities of mind, the ones that are bright, that are blameless, that are... etc., etc. Yeah, so understanding these two things. And again, if you look and you compare that to the Satipatthana Sutta, it is very, very similar to what we see in the Satipatthana Sutta. Satipatthana Sutta, for those of you who are familiar with that sutta, you know it's divided into four sections. It starts off with the Kaya Nupassana, contemplation of the body, the Veda Nupassana, contemplation of feelings, the Chitta Nupassana, contemplation of mental qualities, and then the last one is the Dhamma Nupassana, which is something like contemplation of aspects of causality or something like that, because it shows you, it's contemplation into how phenomena arise. And this second Sambhojanga is very, very similar to the last one, the Dhamma Nupassana. If you read the section on the contemplation of Dhamma Nupassana, it is all about, it starts off with the five hindrances, yeah? And then it tells you, this is how you contemplate the five hindrances. First of all, you know that the hindrance is present in the mind. You know what causes its arising. You know how it is abandoned, because if you know the cause, you know also the abandonment. And then you know how it does not re-arise again in the future. I think that's about roughly right. It's hard to... I think that's roughly what it is. And there may be one more thing there, but that should be roughly what it is. So in other words, what it is all about is understanding causality, how these things come into existence. And this is one of the reasons why I always recommend people at the end of the meditation to reflect back and to think about, understand the causality of the meditation. It is not because we are already doing the Dhamma Nupassana, because Dhamma Nupassana is a very kind of elevated practice, but it gives you a rough idea how to look into the ideas, the idea of causality on the Buddhist path, to see how it all hangs together. And as you do that, of course, you are bound to progress so much faster on this path. And then, of course, after that, the Dhamma Nupassana section has exactly the same framework for the seven factors of awakening themselves, to understand how those seven factors of awakening, how they arise. Yeah, what are the causes behind them, what they are, how they remain, etc., etc. And again, the whole idea of causality for the seven factors of awakening themselves. So understanding the bright and the dark side, understanding the blameworthy and the blameless side, which is what the awakening factor is exactly what we're doing in the last part of the Satipatthana Sutta. Yeah, so it all kind of fits together very nicely. It gels together like this big jigsaw puzzle I was talking about before. And the reason why we investigate these qualities is that when you understand them, then you have the possibility of overcoming them. You can't overcome something you don't even know about. You have to be aware of the fact that it exists. Then you have to be aware of the causality that actually gives rise to these things. And as you do that, it enables you to overcome these things. So this is why on this path you then have the Satisambhojanga, the awakening factor of mindfulness, the awakening factor of investigation of qualities. Then from that comes the awakening factor of energy, the Virya Sambhojanga. The Virya Sambhojanga is then the energy of the mind that arises as a natural consequence of abandoning these defilements. And this is what happens in the mind. When you have mindfulness, you abandon the last defilements, energy comes into the mind. And this is that distinction I was making before between effort. Effort is what we apply, yeah? And effort is what eventually tires you out because you're using willpower, you are kind of pushing yourself to do something, at least to some extent. And energy, on the contrary, is a natural energy that arises in the mind as a consequence of practicing the path. So much more easy, much more beautiful in a sense, because it's something that kind of arises completely according to natural causes and consequences. So the energy arises, yeah? And now things start to become really nice, yeah? Really, really nice. You feel energetic inside. And as it says elsewhere in the suttas, the Siddhi, you have this tireless energy because it is a natural energy. It feels like it can never run out. It feels like it's always going to be there. Of course it isn't, because then some defilement arrives again and bang, you're back to square one. But it feels like when you're there, it feels like, whoa, this is going to be like this forever. That's what it feels like. Yeah. And because it is natural, it is not something that you are applying in your practice. So. And then from that Virya Sambhujanga comes the Piti Sambhujanga. Piti, we talked about before, is the joy and rapture of the path, on the path of meditation, very often felt physically in the body. It's beautiful, powerful joy that you feel in meditation practice. From that Piti comes the Pasabdhi Sambhujanga, the factor of awakening, which is tranquility. Tranquility arises. Can you remember this now? Remember we talked about this before? From Piti comes tranquility. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you remember that on the second day or whatever we talked about this, right? And then from that tranquility comes the Samadhi Sambhujanga, the factor of awakening, which is the stillness of the mind. Again, very similar to what we saw on the first day. Not exactly the same, there's a slight variation in the sequence here, but very, very similar. And then the Samadhi arises because you become so still. The tranquility steals everything down. You become so peaceful. You get this kind of rock-like quality. You just want to sit there. And the happiness that comes from that, the sukha, that's what it was called in that other sutta, draws you towards that. And it's almost completely natural to become still because the experience is so powerful and so blissful and so happy. You get drawn into the object and you have no choice but to enter samadhi as a consequence. Unless you freak out, that is, of course, and people usually freak out a bit at this stage, but otherwise you will get drawn into the samadhi by this. And then when you practice the samadhi and you do that again and again, eventually you reach the upekkha sambhujanga. And the upekkha sambhujanga is the factor of awakening, which is equanimity. So when you get to the really high samadhi, like the fourth jhana and these kind of things, you gain this absolute evenness of mind, where you are completely unshakable. It's called, in the sutras, it's called anenja. Anenja often translated as imperturbability. Imperturbability means you cannot be perturbed, you cannot be shaken, you cannot be moved. You are solid, right? Absolutely solid. Nothing in the whole world, whatever it is that you see, will not shake your mind. It is imperturbable. Quite a nice word. I like that word, imperturbable. That's quite a nice word. It sounds what it means like, imperturbable. That is the this idea. This is the sequence, right? And then, of course, when the mind is absolutely imperturbable like that, it means you can direct it to whatever you like. Even the most scary things that may seem scary, they're actually not scary at all, of course, but things that seem scary, things like non-self, things like seeing that things you thought were happiness are actually suffering. All of these things are possible to realize because the mind is so incredibly powerful at this point. And this is the whole point of the path, to create a mind that is so powerful that it's possible to break through to these very profound truths. The more powerful the mind is, the more ability it has to make that breakthrough. So these are these seven sambhujangas. And if you remember from that early sutta, it's very, very, very similar to that. We talked about the piti, we talked about non-remorse or non-regret leading to pamuja, gladness leading to piti, the rapture leading to tranquility, and then the happiness and the samadhi, and then seeing things according to reality. So this is, you can see the similarities here. And this is one of the things about the suttas. Once you start to understand the structure of these things, you can see the similarities weaving themselves across the suttas, different, slightly different interactions with the different factors, but essentially the same thing again and again and again in different ways. And after a while, you get this broad picture of what the Dhamma is about. And you start to understand this big jigsaw puzzle kind of starts to hang together. And this is kind of what I'm trying to do. I've been reading this for 20 years. I'm finally, after 20 years, starting to get some idea what they are about. It takes a while, And that is why I'm going to help you guys out now to kind of speed up the process a little bit, right? So you don't need 20 years. You can do it in, I don't know, we'll see what happens. So, those are the seven factors of awakening in a little bit of detail. And now let us go backwards on this this path and see where it takes us. So then the Buddha says, well, what is the nutriment for the seven factors of awakening? And of course, as I have been saying, that of course is the seven seven the four establishments of mindfulness, or the four applications of mindfulness, which is the support of the seven factors of awakening. And I have shown you already how that is the case, because the main purpose of the establishments of mindfulness is to overcome the defilements of the mind, and then move the mind towards samadhi. That is the main purpose of these things. And then after samadhi, you can also use these establishments of mindfulness for deep insight as well. But prior to that, it is insight into the defilement that really matters. I think I'll leave it at that. So what then is the nutriment for these four establishments of mindfulness? And the answer is the three kinds of good conduct. And this is one of the things that, again, I have been kind of stressing already a lot. But here it comes again. This is what I mean. The themes that kind of re-emerge again and again in the suttas. And this, of course, is the idea that it's sila, that is the foundation of meditation practice. The foundations of mindfulness, or the applications of mindfulness, is all about using the mind, using meditation in such a way as to overcome the defilements. And the cause of that, what enables that meditation to work, is sila, here termed the three kinds of good conduct. So when you just start off by practicing right by body and speech, when you do the five precepts, you take it beyond that. Already, you are kind of enabling yourself in terms of practicing sila. And the deeper you take the sila, the more you apply all the three kinds of good conduct, including the mind here, the more you do that, the more powerful that meditation is going to be. So again, the same themes re-emerging again and again, you can see here. There's actually one thing I forgot to mention that I should have mentioned as well. If you go back to the other sequence that we had before, you will see that that other sequence has the five hindrances at the very end. The five hindrances is the nutriment for delusion. And the position of the five hindrances in the opposite sequence is exactly the same position that we here have for the four applications of mindfulness. So the four applications of mindfulness is the reverse of the five hindrances. Occurred in exactly the same place in the reverse sequence. So again, it's just to point out that, you know, it shows you to a large extent what these applications of mindfulness are all about, because they occur in the same position in this sequence of things. Sila is the cause. Sila is the nutriment for the four applications of mindfulness. What then is the nutriment for the three kinds of good conduct? And now we are kind of following backwards exactly the same sequence as we had before. So we look at it in brief only this time, because we've seen it already pretty much. And the answer is restraint of the sense faculties. So to be able to have the three kinds of good conduct, your mind has to be reasonably even. It can't be all over the place. You can't kind of attach and be averse and desire all kind of stuff, because it means that you're going to lose certainly your mental good conduct, but it also tends to affect all the good conduct when your mind is not reasonably even and reasonably steady, but all over the place. So that is the restraint of the sense faculties. And what is the cause for the restraint of the sense faculties? Mindfulness and clear comprehension, sati sampajanya. You have to have the mindfulness to know what is happening again. I'm just reminding you very briefly what's going on here. You have to have the mindfulness to know what is going on. And you have to have the sampajanya, the full awareness, the clear comprehension, to know whether what is happening is right or wrong, appropriate or inappropriate, whether it's going to lead forward on the path or backwards into the, into worse state than you already had. And then cause for that, or the nutriment for that, is careful attention, wise attention, yoniso manasikara. You have to look at things, you have to be circumspect, you have to be careful, look at things, from the right point of view, to be able to move forward on this path. So you have this careful attention to ensure that the wholesome qualities are going up, the bad qualities are going down, and you know how to apply the mind in such a way that that happens, and that is then and becomes the source for sampajanya and sati, because you know, wow, I've got to be careful. If I'm not careful, I'm going to go backwards on the path. You know what to prioritize in life, what really matters in life. You throw out those things that are kind of irrelevant, and you focus on those things that are going to bring true happiness. And of course, then the nutriment for wise attention is sadha, faith, confidence. You start off with the word of the Buddha. The Buddha tells you, this is the way to attend carefully. This is the way to be wise, yeah? You start off with that. And because you have confidence in what the Buddha is saying, you start attending in that way. Yeah? So when the Buddha says, if you are attending to another person in such a way that it gives rise to anger, that's called unwise attention. So you look at that person in a different way. Yeah? And then anger doesn't arise. Yeah? People is the most difficult thing in life, right? People is just number one on the list of difficult things. Everybody has that problem. People are also things that we love the most. We're also closest to them. Yeah, hopefully, you know, we certainly the Buddha. Wow, the Buddha is an amazing person. On the other hand, there are always difficult people in the world. And that's just how it is. Because we are close to each other, we do kind of silly things all the time. It makes life... people make life both miserable and happy for the most of us. And there was a famous quote, Ajahn Brahm once pointed that out to me. Was it Ajahn Brahm or somebody? I'm trying to remember now who pointed that out to me. It was a point, was something by the French philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre. And he said something, what did he say again now? I can't remember now. My mind is not really clear enough for this. He said something to the effect that other people... something to the effect that other people are suffering here. What is suffering in the world? Other people are suffering here. That's what he basically said there. And so he had kind of understood a little bit of Dhamma, I think. Yes, that was kind of nice. So how do we do that? And this is one of the things I want to talk about later on, but just to kind of get you to maybe to start off on these things, because these things are really fundamental for moving forward on the path. How do we actually look at other people in such a way as to reduce ill will and problems with other people? And it's incredibly simple. Part of all of these things is to put it into practice and actually do it again and again and again so it has an effect on us. That is the hardest part. But actually, it is really simple. It is not hard to let go of the vast majority of negativity and ill will towards other people. So how do we do it? And the way we do it is... you focus on the good qualities of the other person. Yeah? And it depends, of course, on how many good qualities the other person has. But in a group like this, there are heaps of good qualities. So you look at the people around you and think, why am I looking at that little negative thing when there are so many good qualities there? Let me look at the good quality instead. And if you do that in time, before the negative quality has infested your mind and kind of is stuck there and it's going to be stuck for a long time, if you do it quickly, you're actually able to eliminate that negative outlook pretty much straight away. These techniques are incredibly powerful if you apply them in the right way. I'm just giving you a preview now of what's coming down the line, right? So this is just a, kind of like the, you know, the commercials on TV next week to get this program. So, and the other one is if you can't see any good qualities in other people, then you have compassion for them. Because someone who hasn't got any qualities, good qualities, is in serious trouble, right? I mean, really, really serious trouble. We may think that they are annoying to us, but they are in far more trouble for themselves than they are for us. So you turn the table around, you look at the people in a different way. That's all you have to do. And if you do that consistently, all the time, practice and training yourself to look at people in this way, eventually nobody will ever upset you anymore at all. That's the promise of this kind of practice. Okay, very rarely anyone you, right? Always it's kind of that's putting the bar really, really high, but very, very rarely it's going to happen. So again, very powerful thing. And that's just giving you a slight preview there on how these things actually work. So, and that is all called yoniso manasikara. You move, changing your attention, looking at people in a different way. That is what that all is about. And it comes from the faith. The Buddha is basically saying, this is what we should be doing. So faith gives rise to this wisdom on the Buddhist path then. And what is the cause for this faith, the confidence, the sadha? And the cause, again, is of course hearing the good Dhamma. And what is the cause for hearing the good Dhamma? Of course, now it is to hang out with, to associate with the superior people, the good persons. Is kind of at the root of all of this. So there you are. So that is the reverse sequence. So I'm not sure if there's anything much to add, because we have basically looked at this already in quite a bit of detail. But let's have a quick look at the simile and the concluding paragraph here, because that is also quite nice, of course. So thus associated with good people, becoming full, it fills up hearing the good Dhamma. Hearing the good Dhamma becoming full fills up confidence. Confidence becoming full fills up wise attention. Wise attention becoming full fills up mindfulness and clear comprehension. Mindfulness and clear comprehension becoming full fills up restraint of the sense faculties. Restraint of the sense faculties becoming full fills up the three kinds of good conduct. The three kinds of good conduct becoming full fill up the four applications of mindfulness. The four applications of mindfulness becoming full fill up the seven factors of awakening. The seven factors of awakening becoming full fill up true knowledge and liberation. Thus there is nutriment for true knowledge and liberation, and in this way they become full. Just as when it is raining and the rain pours down in thick droplets on the mountaintop, the water flows down along the slope and fills the clefts, the gullies and the creeks. These becoming full fill up the pools. These becoming full fill up the lakes. These becoming full fill up the streams. These becoming full fill up the rivers. And these becoming full fill up the great ocean. Thus there is nutriment for the great ocean, and in this way it becomes full. So too, associating with good persons leads stage by stage, by becoming full, filling up true knowledge and liberation, filling up insight and liberation. Thus there is nutriment for true knowledge and liberation, and in this way they become full. Yeah, so the same message again, just go back to the basics. And as you do that, these things tend to happen. Yeah, go back to the understanding of the Dhamma, understand what it is about, especially the practical teachings of the Dhamma. One of the interesting points is how much theory should one learn on the Buddhist path? Because sometimes people can spend endless time debating about dependent origination, what it actually means, how it fits together, whether it implies a rebirth or not, and all of these kind of things. And the amount of theoretical knowledge, none of these things are really theoretical. The amount of theoretical knowledge you need is enough to be able to give you a full picture of the Dhamma. Yeah, so when you feel that you have a full picture of the Dhamma, you see all the bits and pieces fitting together, that is how much theoretical knowledge you require. And I remember when I started out as a monk, I read a lot of suttas, and I, you know, learned Pali. Ajahn Brahm was a teacher in those days, so he taught Pali when I was in Anagarika, 20-something years ago, 23 years ago, something like that. And all of that, you kind of, after a while, you build up this kind of map of the Dhamma, and after a while, either you gain confidence in that, or you reject it because it doesn't work out. In my case, it really built up the confidence, because I had the feeling how everything kind of interacts. All the factors interact with each other. So that is how much study is useful. It is useful to build up that confidence that it actually is an overall system that works very nicely and very beautifully. So if you have any doubts, it is good to study a little bit. But don't allow yourself to be taken for a ride by your restless mind, which always wants to study more. When you feel that you have enough confidence, then is where practice really comes in very powerfully. And when you see things happening in your practice that corresponds to the sutta, you see how the defilements are abandoned, how you get clarity of mind, how all of these things come about. of course, that is where the confidence become very powerful as a consequence of that. That is very, very, very useful. One of the things that I didn't really say so much about here, which is also very interesting here, of course, is that the whole thing starts off with seeing the superior people. One thing is to hear the Dhamma, but it's also very useful sometimes to see people who have come some of these qualities. Yeah, sometimes you meet people who think, whoa, check it out, that's really, really, really different. And it's very powerful when you do that, because it really brings the Dhamma alive. When you see somebody who is just different from ordinary people, someone who's cool in pretty much all circumstances, someone who never gets angry, someone who's always peaceful, right? After a while, when you see that, it kind of opens your eyes to a different reality. And you think, I could do with some of those qualities too. I'd like to have some of that, those qualities. They're really good qualities. And it brings the whole thing alive in a very different way. So one thing is listening to talks and reading the suttas, and actually meeting some of these people is also very powerful and very kind of pushes you in the right direction. So if you sometimes, if there are people that you have faith in, it can be nice to meet these people sometimes and see them. And there is somewhere in the suttas where the Buddha says something to the effect that even just seeing an arahant in the world, just seeing a person like that, is tremendously beneficial. Why? Because you see the effect of the Dhamma. You see it in your own eyes. Wow, this is actually the effect of the Dhamma. And then, of course, it brings up so much more confidence and faith when you do that. And sometimes you meet some of these people. Last year, I went to, I have a lot of confidence in Ajahn Brahm. Of course, I've been living in for a long time. But sometimes I also meet other monks. And one of the monks I met last year was he's quite a famous monk in Thailand now. He's called Ajahn Gunha. So I went to meet Ajahn Gunha in Thailand. And he's this kind of small little monk from the northeast of Thailand. He's actually the nephew of Ajahn Chah. And he was very famous for being very attained fairly early on. So I went to visit him. He's a very close associate with our monastery in Perth. And he's been there before on a few occasions and stayed for a year actually at one stage. And so he is very close to us. So when you go there and you say that I'm a disciple of Ajahn Brahm, really? Okay, come in, right? Priority straight away, number one. Okay, we'll give you a few hours. Even though he's really busy, all these people waiting for him, you get straight in front of the line because you are a disciple of Ajahn Brahm. So this is a secret for you, right? If you ever go and see Ajahn Gunha, say you are a disciple of Ajahn Brahm. Right? Straight away, bang, you go in. But you can't lie, so you have to be a disciple first of all. So you go and see this monk, yeah, and you go and see him, and he just sits there. He has this big chair, right? It's going to come half a meter, maybe a meter high. This small little monk, he sits up there, and he just sits there. And he has this smile on his face, yeah, and he kind of looks really holy the way he looks. And all these people are sitting in front of him. He doesn't say very much. He kind of says a few words, he laughs a little bit, and he doesn't kind of do very much at all. He just sits there, and people just kind of amass around him. You wonder what's going on. And of course, what is going on is that people just feel so good in his presence. They just want to sit around him because they can relax, they can chill, they can feel good about themselves, yeah. And this is kind of what happens when you are in the presence of somebody like that. You really feel you can relax. You can be at ease. There's no sense of judgment. There's no sense that somebody is going to kind of to put you in your place or anything like that. There's a feeling of complete acceptance by the other person. And this is what is so beautiful about that. Somebody who is fully awakened, they will never judge you. They will never judge you because they understand that there is nothing there to be judged in the first place. They know that you are just a conglomeration of conditions coming together in this moment. Yeah? How can you judge that? So they don't judge you. And that makes you really relaxed in the presence of people like that. And this is one of the beautiful things when you come into the presence of somebody like Ajahn Gunha. And then he sits there, right? And he has this big ball of sweet next to him. This is kind of really cool as well. Just makes him look a little bit nuts, but actually it's actually quite nice. Big ball of sweet, enormous. And then kind of monks come with bucket of sweet and pour buckets in on a regular basis into this massive tray. And then he has a little dipper that he dips into this massive ball. And he takes the sweet and he throws them out on the assembly. Yeah. So it's raining sweets. And everybody kind of scrambles to get hold of some sweets, right? And it's very touching when you see it, because it's actually very nice. Because the sweets, of course, being sweet, they symbolize the idea of metta. in the presence of metta is so palpable, it's so clear. It's like it's raining down with metta. This week's kind of coming down to you. You take this week, and when you go back home, it reminds you of this monk with all these qualities there. Yeah, and that is what is so nice about that. There are more stories about Ajahn Gandha. You want to, I'll tell you another story about Ajahn Gandha, because I don't want to go on to the next sutta because it kind of takes us in different directions. I'll tell you the story about Ajahn Gandha instead. You probably heard this story before, at least some of you, but it's a nice story. And this is the story of the early days in Thailand. When I say early days, I mean when there still was forest in Thailand. These days have all been chopped down, unfortunately. At that time, the forest monks of that tradition, who were disciples of Ajahn Chah and disciples of all the famous forest monks at that time, they would go on something called Tudong. And Tudong meant traveling around Thailand, walking from one village to another one, finding a nice place to stay, meditating there for a while, and then when they were finished there, move on to the next village. And Ajahn Gandha would be doing the same thing, and he would then travel. It would be him, and it would be all his monks, and they would be traveling around. And then one day, they came to this one village. And when they come to the village, the first thing they do is they ask for the headman of that village. And they speak to him, and they say, well, we want to stay in kind of the forest next to the village. And in the morning, we would like to come in on arms around to collect food for the day. Is that okay? Is the village kind of ready for that? And of course, the headman will say, oh, it's wonderful, it's marvelous. Wow, we're so lucky to have you here. Please come in for arms round in the morning. And this is how they would react in the northeast of Thailand. They would be so happy when they would see monks. They could give them food, right? They would, whoa, be overjoyed, please. And they wouldn't even get any Dhamma teachings often. They would just offer food, and that was pretty much it. That was kind of the culture in that area. And then they walk into the forest, yeah, and they sit down, and they do the meditation for the afternoon and for the evening, yeah. And while they're sitting there in the meditation, they hear something approaching. So initially they think, yeah, no problem, you know, we can deal with a few animals, no issue. So they sit there and meditate. That sound becomes louder and louder and louder until it sounds like this thing, whatever it is right in front of Ajahn Gandha. So at that point, he opens his eyes. And when he opens his eyes, what does he see? What he sees is a king cobra, like this, right, looking him straight in the eye. And for most people, if you see a king cobra like half a meter away, looking you into the eye like that, you have a heart attack and you die on the spot, yeah? You don't die from being bitten, you die from the heart attack you have before you get bitten. The king cobra is known in Thailand, in fact, as the one-step snake. And the reason is because you have one step and then you are finished. After you are bitten by the king cobra, yeah? And so this is what happens to this, the king cobra eyeballing Ajahn Gandha eyeballing the king cobra, right, looking at each other like this. But if you are really, if you've gone a long, long way on this path, you don't have any fear anymore. Fear is completely gone. Because you're not really afraid for your own life. If you die, okay, even better, right? You die, you go to a good rebirth, or ideally go straight to Parinibbana, so all finished. No problem. So you have no fear for your life anymore. And because you have no fear, you have the ability to do things that nobody else in the whole world would do. So what he does, he very carefully raises his arm. Don't go too quickly, because then you scare the cobra, and it bites you straight away. So very slowly, lifts up his arm, pats the king cobra on the head, right? Nice to meet you, king cobra. Thank you very much for visiting. Now it's time for you to move on, right? Okay, move on. And that's what, and the king cobra probably so confused. It probably never happened to this king cobra before. He didn't know what to do. So it goes down on the ground and kind of moves off in a different direction. Yeah, and this, when you, is it a true story? One of the monks from a monastery who went to visit Ajahn Gandha, and he asked him, well, what happened? What did that snake think when you patted it on the head? And Ajahn Gandha said, well, you've got to ask the snake. So it seems to have been a true story. There's no kind of, certainly no denial on the part of Ajahn Gandha. And what is so interesting about that is that it shows you how a being, somebody who has practiced this path to an end, how different they are compared to ordinary people. No fear, no agitation, nothing at all. Completely cool, right in the face of the greatest danger you can almost have as a human being. Yeah, and still so cool. And of course, the king cobra, taken by surprise, just moves off, and everything is fine as a consequence. That is Ajahn Gamhae. So if you ever want to go and meet Ajahn Gamhae in the northeast of Thailand, he's one of those monks that is very nice to meet. He doesn't say very much, right? He says, hello, how are you, where are you from? Oh yeah, okay. And then that's about it. And then you kind of chill out in his presence afterwards. Sometimes he gives Dhamma talks, but it's a very different kind of experience. Sometimes you just go to meet these people just to get a nice feeling. Yeah. One of the other nice stories that Ajahn Ram tells is the story when he went to visit one of the other famous Ajahns in Thailand. Not just in Thailand, these kind of famous people are of course everywhere, but because we have a connection to Thailand, we tend to talk about Thailand more. But actually, people like this exist everywhere. In very small numbers, by the way, but they do exist in many different places. So Ajahn Ram, after his 5 years as a monastic, that is usually when you go around traveling. Yeah, so he went traveling to all these famous monks in the northeast of Thailand. And one of the monks he went to is a monk called Ajahn Tait. Also very, very famous. He was kind of supported by the king and all these kind of things. The king had big this build hall for him called the Mandapa. This Mandapa, very ornate, full of gold and colors and all that kind of stuff. So Ajahn Brahm went to Ajahn Tait's monastery here. And as he kind of approached the monastery, he was thinking, yeah, I'm going to ask him all these questions right here. Is it the real deal? Got this really good monk here. I'm going to take the opportunity and ask him all of these tricky Dhamma questions about dependent origination, maybe, and this kind of thing. So, actually, I'm just making that up. probably completely wrong. But it's probably the last thing you ask these people is about dependent origination. He goes there, right? And then he goes to this big hall, this mandapa, this thing building built by the king. And he has been told that Ajahn Tait is sitting in this big hall. So he goes into this hall. And when he goes into the hall, he looks around. There's nobody there. It's empty. What happened to Ajahn Tait? And then he looks one more time. And he sees this old monk sitting in the corner over there that he hadn't seen on the first time around. And he realized later on that the reason why he hadn't seen him is because somebody who has no sense of self, they have very little presence. Yeah, they don't make anything out of themselves. It's almost as if they kind of disappear into the environment because there is no personality there to kind of make you into anything. Yeah, you are just this part of nature disappearing into the wall almost, becoming part of the surroundings. And when he saw that, when he saw Ajahn Tait sitting kind of in the distance like there, completely selfless, without any kind of feeling of being anybody, suddenly his mind went completely blank. It went completely empty here. Because the feeling was this feeling of complete peace, the feeling of being, of not being in the presence of anybody at all, really. And then he went forward and he sat down in the presence of Ajahn Tait, and he said for the first time in his life, he felt this feeling again of being completely accepted in the presence of somebody else. No judgment. Yeah, no sense that this person is going to look at you in the wrong way. Only compassion, only kindness, only these very positive feelings coming out of this person. And of course, he felt a bit stupid because he had come with all these questions. And now he didn't know what to say. He just said hello, and then that was it. So they had a little conversation, right, or where you kind of understand the things. But he never got around to asking those questions because he said his mind went so peaceful when he was in the presence of a great person like that. And this is the advantage, right, of meeting some of these superior people, meeting some of these astonishing beings in the world. And sometimes I talk about monks, but there are nuns that are reputed to be like this as well. It's important to remember there are two sides of the story. Sometimes there are even lay people who are really highly realized and have gone a long way on this path. Although normally you find it among monastics, because that is where you find that the path is practiced with more commitment, right, and more perseverance. But people like this still exist in the world in the present day. And sometimes it's nice if you feel that you have confidence in the suttas, confidence in the Buddhist teachings. Sometimes it can be nice to meet these people and see how, what this path actually can do to you when you practice it all the way like this. I will tell some more stories later on about some other people I know about, because it's actually quite nice to hear some of these stories. I get inspired myself, and then maybe we can all get inspired by these things. Okay, so I'm going to stop there. And so that is all for now, but I'll see you again at 7:30 this evening here.